Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Assessing a person's legal matter often requires extensive interviews, review of contracts and documents, and research of the current state of the law on the issues involved. As a result, the information provided by the attorneys and guests of All Things Legal is given for informational purposes only. It is not to be construed as legal, tax, investment, or other professional advice. Communications with the attorneys on this program, whether verbal or digital, do not create an attorney-client relationship.
Good morning. Doug Santeri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. Call 260-1870 or text us at 870-870 about your legal question, your LSU question, your Tulane question, or your Saints question.
There you go.
It's big football weekend, huh?
Big football weekend. We can have the trifecta if the Saints show up, and it'd be great if they won this game. And it'd show a lot of naysayers.
Now, somebody like, you know, Bob Remy or, you know, one of the sports historians could probably just call and say, how many times LSU Tulane and the Saints won on the same weekend?
You can't. I thought you'd have that information right off the top of your head.
Now, I would guess it's in the 80s, 70 or 80 times. That would be my guess. But I would defer.
I would have no clue.
I would defer to Bob Remy.
There you go.
So I don't know what to talk about first. I mean, Tulane game was phenomenal.
Right.
What in the name of Tommy Casanova, Warren Capone, and Patrick Peterson happened to the LSU defense? You know, I mean, but if you look at the score, you think it was a basketball game.
Right, right.
And then the Saints have a very tough game.
They have a tough game. It's a very good team.
I will say this. Sean Payton is a great coach. His level of greatness – he can have a different level of greatness if he somehow navigates his team to 500 or sometime something over 500 in the next four, six, seven games.
Listen, he's the master game planner. He will game plan. He has been game planning for Drew Brees at the helm, and everything has been designed around that. Now he's game planning. He's had that week to now game plan against Terry Bridgewater. I was a big proponent of Bridgewater.
Are you?
Well, I mean, I don't think he played as badly as people made it out to.
When you got to come in for injured quarterback, you didn't get the reps.
Right.
I mean,
having nothing to do
dynamics.
With that, though, he started off, he completed a couple of passes, and then there was a holding penalty. So instead of getting the ball 15 yards up the field, it's first and 20. You know, he had like eight drop passes, and you're gonna get that because he throws a stiffer pass than the soft pass that Drew Brees throws to a spot.
You were saying that before the show, and I mean, I never thought about that. I think that was a wonderful point.
Well, I mean, you know, so guys have to adjust. I mean, even though they're pros, they've been working with the ones, and so Drew's at the helm, and he's throwing to a spot. He's throwing to a softer pass than Bridgewater's throwing. So a lot of passes went through guys' hands. They hit them in the hands and it went through them because it's just that split second, that hair of a second that they close their hands a little tighter and quicker. And it's frustrating. You know, when you're out there and you complete a 15-yard out route and it's beautiful and you're moving the team down the field, then all of a sudden that same play, there's a holding penalty. And look, that team – They play the Raiders. The Rams. They play the Super Bowl team, one of the best defenses in football, and arguably the best player in football on Aaron Donald. And I mean, they had some kind of election of the best player in football, number one. Drew Brees was number two.
Right.
And so, and then all of a sudden, Pete gets hurt, and now we've got a backup trying to block. Arnold. I mean, Donald. They were faced with a lot of things, and let me tell you, they were a couple of plays away from being right in the game. They give them that.
You know, I want to talk about this, and this is, you know, a referee is about enforcement of rules, so it's, you know, got some tie to legal. One of the things, I was a former basketball official, baseball,
uh-huh.
And one of the things, and I'll tell you, in the NBA, when they train their officials, there's a lot of walking, there's a lot of fouls, a lot of 3 seconds, a lot of over the back, mm-hmm. a lot of technical violations of the rule every NBA game.
Just like a football game.
Right.
There's holding on every play.
Now, what the NBA tells its referees is that if it's a two-prong analysis. One, do they commit a violation? And two, does that violation have an unfair advantage in that particular play?
Right.
So in other words, if you have over the back, but it had nothing to do with the ultimate outcome of that rebound or what have you, they don't make the call.
Right.
If you have 3 seconds and it has no advantage, the referee will probably say, get out the lane. Try to get them out the lane before they call. You contrast with the NFL, which drives me up the wall to the point, and I feel like Tom Brady does. I don't even want to watch a game that's not involving the Saints.
Right.
Because if you have, for example, a punt return, and you have a block in the back 15 yards behind the returner, you don't call it.
Don't call
it. There was no advantage gained by that.
That same thing happened. I'm watching the Tulane game. And their second-to-last drive where Tulane scored a touchdown, they handed off. It was like a little sweep right, and the guy and the guy ran all the way up to the 15-yard line or something, and they called it back for a holding penalty. He was 10 or 15 yards ahead of the hold, and the guy was holding at the line of scrimmage, and it was barely a hold. I mean, it was marginal at best, but they called it, and it did not affect the play. He was up 15 yards up the sideline.
And somewhere in these referees' head, I don't know what in the heck it is, they think that people pay $80,000 in a box seat to watch darn referees. And it takes away from the game. You let them play. Now, maybe if you want to call it tight the first series or two,
mm-hmm.
just to set a tone, you let them play. Now,
well, and then it's just a pain. You know, you might as well not punt the ball anymore. Because there's always a hold or a block in the back. Always. I mean, it's just, it's a great run back. You know, if it's not a fair catch, it somebody runs the ball for 20 or 30 yards, they'll find a block in the back somewhere. They'll find a hole. They'll find something.
It's frustrating. It drives me crazy. Like, for example, if you have a big play and they'll say, the outside wide receiver wasn't lined up in the line of scrimmage.
Right.
And it was maybe 6 inches, which is barely detectable by.
Well, that happened last night. Notre Dame was upset about it. Kelly was like,
"Are you kidding me?
Tell him to scoot up. He's standing right next to you. He checked with you to make sure he was on the line of scrimmage, and you got to tell him to scoot up." And the ref wouldn't listen to him. But anyway, getting back to Terry Bridgewater though, before I was rudely interrupted.
Teddy.
No, I just think that I think that he's now going to be the game plan is going to be around Teddy Bridgewater's skill set.
Sure.
And so I think this is where a guy like Sean Payton shines. He's going to go in there and have Teddy Bridgewater manage a game. They were two plays away from it being a 4-point game or 6-point game.
Sure.
They had the one penalty.
Right.
That the negated the touchdown, and they have I think they ended up with 9 points. So if you give them that seven, you're at 16.
Swing. Yeah, it's a 10-point swing.
Yeah, and then you also look at that one pass that the receiver broke away, between two or three people for a touchdown. It was like this long pass at the end of the game where it kind of didn't matter. And you take that away, it's a 20-16 game, and the Saints are right in it with – with the devastation and the depression of Terry Bridgewater. I'm not Terry Bridgewater.
Teddy.
Teddy. I'm Teddy Bridgewater. I'm sorry. But of Drew Brees hurting his thumb.
Yeah.
And that's how I think they keep talking about 6 weeks for Drew. I think he's coming back after the bye.
I'd rather have him healthy.
Yeah.
And not re-injure it rather than come back too soon.
Let me tell you what your thumb does.
Okay.
When you're under center is when it matters most. He can put him in the shotgun, but that thumb is what the ball hits every time the ball is snapped.
Ouch, ouch.
Yeah, and so it's just an impact to that thumb. Gripping the ball is one thing, but when you have that impact every time to your thumb, it's going to take it longer.
Let me ask you this question about the game plan. Do you think Sean Payton is going to channel Charlie McClendon and do a modified two-quarterback system? In a sense, not in a traditional – you know, series by series, but do you think he's going to?
I think he'll have some Taysom Hill packages. I think he'll have, you know, maybe six or so plays where Taysom goes in, and he might even go in as a flanker. Or he, this is where I think you're going to see the Swiss Army knife a little bit, do a few things to take a little pressure off of Bridgewater.
Now, for the millennials, Charlie McClendon used to be the coach at LSU from 1961 to 1979. And Charlie McClendon was a good coach, not a great coach, but he was a coach if you had – Burt Jones was John Elway before John Elway. That's his skill set. And he only played him half the time.
Right.
Because he platooned him with Paul Lyons and some other quarterbacks, Buddy Lee.
Yeah.
So but – that's just an explanation for millennials. I think if they have packages for Taysom, it sort of keeps the Seattle defense off balance.
That's right. Okay, we've not scouted this. We've not game planned for this. What do we do here? And so that helps Bridgewater, takes a little bit of the rush away, perhaps. Yeah. And
now we got a text that says, talking about referees, if it doesn't affect the play. This is from, I think, 9238. If it doesn't affect the play, it shouldn't be called. That was good. He said brilliant, but I don't want to pat myself on the back. It would save the NFL. It has become unwatchable at times.
It has.
It's just ridiculous. But that goes to the darn commissioner.
Oh, that so goes many because things, so many things go to the $50 million man.
Because the commissioner would
say $50 million a year to do nothing.
He's got a franchise that cannot be destroyed if you tried it, and he's doing everything he can to compromise it by well-documented decisions. But he has taken the NFL game, and I have to honestly say, if the Saints aren't playing, I could take it or leave it, unless maybe it's the Falcons.
Yeah.
Or Carolina.
And we've talked about this before. A guy who needs to be in the Hall of Fame is the guy who invented fantasy football, because so many people will then watch the Carolina Cincinnati game,
the Browns and the Jets.
Yeah, because they got a guy playing.
Yeah,
you know, and their team they're playing this week has somebody playing.
Okay. I tell you what, let's go to let's take a call. Natural transition from Saints to inheritance. Kevin, let's go to Kevin. Kevin, you know all things legal, Doug Sincere and Albert Nico.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. How
absolutely.
Y'all doing?
Hey, thanks good. For calling with a legal call so we can shut up about the sports, right?
No, I'm talking more sports later.
Now that I notice it, I'm in my backyard. I got a tree hanging over my fence.
Oh, Lord.
Oh, no.
I'm just kidding. I'm looking forward to the game today.
Oh, me too.
Yeah, yeah. It's an adventure.
I think it will rise.
Bridgewater's a talented kid. He was a Pro Bowler. He's just going to get a little comfort level back there and do some good things.
I hope so.
Uh-huh.
I hope so. I feel a little guilty because right before the game, we were sitting at my son's camp. And you know how they always talk about them making them to the Super Bowl and blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know, the thing that always cracks me up is the biggest variable in football is injuries. What the hell is going to happen? What's going to happen if Drew gets injured?
Oh, you put
like
the mouth
Manning
on
him?
No,
that's what he said. Man, he comes down. You had to open your mouth. Here's the question. My wife, her brother, and her stepsister.
Okay.
Selling a house next month. Left to them by my wife's parents. So what taxes are we responsible for? Is it state
None.
And federal?
There are no state inheritance taxes, and the federal estate tax is, you know, you got to be it's like $11 million bucks.
Kevin, I usually ask, do you own a football team?
Right.
And if you say no, I say chances are you're not going to pay federal death taxes.
Yeah. So for all intents and purposes. Yeah, there are no state inheritance taxes, and for the most part, there are no federal and estate taxes either.
No, she's only getting about probably $35,000 share of the house.
The beauty of it is she gets what's called a stepped-up basis. So if her parents bought the house for $20,000 in the 50s, and now it's worth $150,000, that income or that gain goes away, and when your wife inherits it, she gets it at the new basis of 150, basically her portion of it. So if she turns around and sells it, they don't pay a capital gain on it unless it sells for more than 150, if that makes sense. Then it's a small little capital gain.
So basically, nothing, no state, no federal, no inheritance tax.
Correct.
Unless you're extremely wealthy.
Right.
So you good, okay, Kevin?
All right, Kevin, thanks for the call. Go Saints.
Let's go to break. Doug Sincere, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Sincere, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers on WWLAMFM.com. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Brian. He's got a question regarding disability. Hey, Brian, you're on all things legal with Doug Sincere and Albert Nico. Brian.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Good
morning.
How are you, sir?
As far as the Saints, I truly believe that this game in Seattle, they are going to play not just because they're Saints and they got to play good, but they're going to be playing this for the quarterback that got them where they did.
Absolutely.
I agree.
I mean, there's only two ways to react to a situation like that. It's to pack in your tents or just, you know, dig deeper. And we're hoping for digging deeper.
That second Super Bowl ring is really going to look nice on their fingers.
That's right.
I have a question. It is. It's gorgeous. I wish I had one of those Super Bowl rings.
What you got?
For decades, I was on Social Security disability from a permanent injury.
SSDI.
And now that I reached 65, they changed that over to regular Social Security.
Right.
Recently, I just sold my house for $98,000. I'm trying to find a tax person that would know the law to handle this for me, because I don't know how this will affect my Social Security, the regular Social Security.
It won't, because there's two types of Social Security, SSI and SSDI. The very short version is SSI is based on your need and disability. So you basically have to have a threshold of less than $2,000 in countable assets. SSDI you get because you paid into the system and you became disabled. And so what you paid into the system is paying you disability. So I like to explain it this way. Tom Benson, if he would have became disabled before 65, he could have collected SSDI. Doesn't matter how much money you make, because you paid into the system and you became disabled. So it's coming out of a different pot. Now,
yes, sir.
If your SSI is basically, it's not based on what you paid into the system, it's based on having a disability and having less than $2,000 of countable assets. So there's two distinctions. Since you paid into SSDI because of your employment, that would have no effect on your Social Security, selling your house.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Should I obtain a special tax person or A regular tax person should know this information?
A regular tax person knows it. The other thing is, when you sold your house, you may have to pay a little capital gain on it.
But there's some exemptions.
Yeah, there's some exemptions, and depending on age and things like that. So those are the kind of things you need to ask
the tax guy.
Yeah, the tax
guy. But don't.
Yes, sir.
But the Social Security, if you are receiving SSDI, it's not an issue as far as Social Security on selling your house. That's apples and orange. Have no relationship.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Okay, thank y'all so much, and I enjoy your show every
weekend.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate you listening.
It's nice to give good news to someone every once in a while. All right, let's go to Elwin. Elwin's got a domicile question. Hey, Elwin, you're in all things legal. What you got for us, brother?
Hey, man, I went through the domicile. I had some people that were staying with me. I can't name their names.
Okay.
I had a time getting rid of them.
Okay.
Because they were talking about the domicile law, and I got roughed up.
Well, what happens is if you invite someone to stay at your home, and it could be construed as some type of informal lease, at times you can't, if you may have trouble getting them to leave, and sometimes you're required to file an eviction. For example, I'm not saying this is your situation, if you're a person and you invite someone to shack up with you. That's being said like a father of four daughters. But anyway, if they come in and shack up and they live for 6 months, 8 months, or 10 months, and you want them out, most of the time in that type of situation, you just can't tell them to get out. You're going to have to get some type of eviction proceeding to get that person out. So is that what you're referring to, where someone came to live with you and it was hard to get them out?
No, what I did was I invited some people over because the person came from Sulphur. And they stood 15 days. They stood 30 days, okay? And the problem was they was saying that if it's over 30, if it's 30 days.
No, if you invited them to stay, they are there at your request. You're paying the bills. You're the person that's got the lease, and so you're the person that the landlord gives you permission to stay. You give them permission to stay. You can revoke that permission at any time unless there's some sort of written agreement or even oral agreement for them to be able to stay beyond
that.
Yeah. Look, this is what I did. I said, y'all can stay, but y'all can only stay for 15 days. So they took it the wrong way, and you know, they took it the wrong way, and so they you know, I had to get the police here. The police didn't want to put them out, and it just went into a problem that I, you know, that I couldn't, like Doug said,
you might have to go to, you know, to get a justice of the peace or a city court judge to confirm that they have to get out.
And what you'd have to do.
Yeah, but they left on their own now. They're gone.
Then they voluntarily vacated the property and they vacated any rights to.
I gave them so much hassle.
Good.
That they left.
There you go.
That's the pragmatic way.
That's the better pragmatic way to do it.
All right. All right, Ellen.
Thanks for the call,
thanks for the call. All right, let's go to Fred's got a question regarding succession. Hey, Fred, you and all things legal with Doug Sinceri and Albert Nico.
Good morning. I wonder, what if you don't do a succession and someone passes away? What happens?
Do they have immovable property, real estate?
Yes.
All right, well, then the problem is at some point that real estate is going to have to change hands. And so we do have deeds, but we're more interested in Louisiana with what's called a chain of title. And so whatever's recorded in the mortgage records is really considered that chain of title. So if you know, let's say your mom dies and she owns a piece of property and it never gets put in the kids' names, if somebody goes and checks the public records at the clerk's office, they're going to think that the mom still owns the house. So if those children want to, you know, go to the bank and borrow money to improve the home or whatever the case may be, they're not going to be listed as owners. And so the succession is going to have to be opened to place those heirs in possession of that real estate. And, you know, technically, if there's a vehicle, if there's anything with a title if it's just some movable property, some furniture, some jewelry, some whatever, and the heirs agree, then you can go ahead and split it up and you would need to open a succession.
What about the bank accounts?
Depends on how much money we're talking about. If it's $125,000 now, it used to be $75,000 for a small succession. And what you can do is go to a lawyer and have them prepare what's called a small succession affidavit. Get all of the heirs to agree to sign the affidavit confirming the kind of who the heirs are and why they're heirs to that succession and how that money's supposed to be distributed. Then you don't need to go through the courts and file a petition for possession or you know, anything of that sort. You can get it done.
What if it's more?
Then you have to go through a succession because the bank is going to want to see either a judgment of possession, or they're going to want to see someone who is the executrix, an independent executrix or executor appointed by the court to handle the affairs of the deceased. And once they have those letters from the clerk issued by the clerk to that person, authorizing them to handle the estate, they will then turn the money over to that person.
Okay. Thank you all so much. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you, Fred, for calling. You know, and a lot of people that you get these scare ads from a lot of attorneys who are doing estate planning and things like that they want to write these revocable living trusts and all these expensive tools, and they tell you, oh, you want to avoid probate. Probate is not an expensive process. Especially if you got an estate over $125,000, you know, for literally a few thousand dollars, you can have your estate
Probated,
if you taken have a will, care of. Yeah, and if there's a will, I mean, it's just
independent administrator,
all of that sort of thing. It's just not an expensive process. Now, look, if there's infighting among the heirs, if there's a business to continue to run, et cetera, and there's a lot of communication between the executor and the attorney, then yeah, then that bill's going to get a little higher. But there's that administration is the expensive part, not necessarily the probating of the will and the filing of the proceedings. That's going to be kind of more expensive anyway, because somebody's got to get appointed to handle all of those things and handle them. But if it's strictly, you know, like we say, a spouse in a house or something like this and some assets, it's a real inexpensive thing. Everything's, you know, done and official. And then if, you know, two generations later, you don't have to go back and correct all
of lot of times, even if you do a trust, there's still some assets that are left out. You end up opening a succession anyway.
So well, and they're charging $7,500, $10,000 to do these trusts, and it's like, wow.
You know, it's simple. Keep it simple. You know,
if you don't people come in and ask me. I want to form a trust, and I ask them why. I want them to be able to articulate to me why they want a trust, because there are reasons to have trust, and I'm a proponent of them. I don't want them to want to trust because some lawyer that's out there selling them wants to.
You know, I will say this. It's sort of interesting. Back, I think, in 1990, when I was working for Bill Becknell and Dave McDaniel, they did a will for a certain football owner.
Right.
Guess who that may be. And it was only 9 pages. And at that time, you know, David, who was one of my, you know, mentor who taught me a lot, he said, you know, more is not always better. And he said, you know, keeping it simple and straightforward, he used to keep it simple, stupid, is often more effective than trying to deal with contingencies that have a 1 out of 1 million chance of occurring and using 10 pages of documents to deal with that.
Right.
So
yeah, because inevitably the more complicated it gets, the more in opposite
footholds.
Terms, they may, yeah.
Footholds people have.
Yeah, it's like, oh, wait a minute. Well, you said this in page 16.
Now it says, yeah,
right.
Now this says it's page
40. I want it to go to my 4 kids. I want them to split it equally. And if one of them dies, to go to their children. Okay, we can do that.
And so more is not always better. Do you want, Dave, you want to go to another? Let's go to Bruce. He's got a question regarding car purchase. Hey, Bruce, you're on All Things Legal with Doug Sinterra and Albert Nico.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I've got a sister who I bought a car for a couple of weeks ago. I've put the car in her name.
Okay.
But in order to pass along my good rates on insurance, I had to put the insurance in both of our names, specifically me as primary driver. I don't want to be liable for anything that happens in case she gets in a wreck. I'm just wondering if I should do it that way or just put
I'm not saying whether you should or shouldn't, but you would not be liable, because the only time a person is liable is if they're not a if you throw the keys to someone who's in an impaired condition and say drive, at some point they could be a problem. And two, if they're not a invited driver.
Permissive user.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Exactly. So it just because you own a vehicle does not make you liable. The only reason that your insurance comes into play is because in Louisiana, your insurance company is the primary insurance on that vehicle. And so just because you happen to own that insurance policy, you are covered and that vehicle is covered. But if you're not driving the vehicle, unless there is, two or three exceptions, but unless there's like a permissive user where you're on a mission, like, so I'm telling you, I want you to go here and pick up this cedar chest in my truck and bring it back to me. Now, all of a sudden, you're on a mission for me. I'm benefiting from it. So they may be able to kind of get past that. But if it's just your daughter driving her vehicle, she's a relatively safe driver. You're not going to have any liability. The driver is going to be the one that's going to have the excess exposure, not the owner of the vehicle. Now, if the vehicle's brakes go out if it's not maintained properly and you're the owner of the vehicle, you can have some liability as a result of that. But if it's strictly, you know, your daughter driving an otherwise, you know, mechanically sound vehicle, you should be fine.
Okay. Let me clarify this. It's not my daughter. It's my sister.
Our sister.
Okay.
Either so.
Okay. And the car is in her name fully.
Okay.
The only thing that's got my name on it is the insurance policy. And in order to get the insurance, the good insurance rates, they had to use me as the primary insured. And of course, that would mean the primary driver.
Doesn't matter. So it doesn't matter.
The policy itself has my name and then her name right
doesn't
next
matter.
To it.
The owner of the policy just means that that's the person covered. The liability is going to be on the driver.
All right. Thanks for the call, Bruce. We've got to go to a break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We'll be right back after this brief timeout. Hey, we're back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. Let's go to phone lines. Let's go to Amy's got a question regarding car insurance and registration. Hey, Amy, you and all things legal with Doug Cinceri and Albert Nico. Amy.
Hi, good morning, guys.
What you got for us?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I have a situation. I have a vehicle that I purchased about 5 years ago. I'm close to paying it off. I had a co-signer at the time. When they did the loan documents, I guess, and the registration, they listed him as, I guess, the primary before me because his credit was better than mine.
Okay.
So I've come to a situation now where he is deceased for 3 years now.
Okay.
I have an insurance cancellation on the car. So I went to the DMV to pay the cancellation, and they told me I needed to get succession papers and all that stuff from the courthouse. So I called the courthouse. My car wasn't listed on his succession because nobody honestly really even thought about it at the time.
Who's listed on a title? Who's listed on a title?
Both of us.
And wait, so you're trying to pay the insurance?
Insurance got canceled, and she's trying to get reinstated.
Right, and they won't let you pay.
The reinstatement fee. They want the signature of the other owner who's deceased.
Oh Lord!
You know
That's
what?
Right.
Yeah. So there is a form. There is a form on the internet. You go to. It's called One Stop. No, it's not One Stop. It's darn it. Yeah, but it's Office of Motor Vehicle website. Go to their website, and you're going to go look for forms. It's going to be an affidavit of heirship form.
Yeah.
Go get that form. Have their, whoever the heirs are of this person, have them sign that. It's going to be a pain in the butt because you got to get a notary to notarize their signatures. But have them sign that and either put your name on the vehicle as the owner of the vehicle or, you know, in this, that way they don't have to get involved with the DMV. And then you can just be the owner of the vehicle and they can list you as the owner and that should be enough.
I already did that.
Oh, wow.
I had that. And the lady at the DMV was telling me that they needed a copy of the probated.
No, you don't.
No, you don't.
In those situations, you always say, may I speak to your supervisor?
Right.
Because a lot of the intake people have wrong information.
Right.
And a lot of times if you get to someone with knowledge as opposed to without knowledge, then you can help, they can more process. Because, again, when you're dealing with intake front line, they can't get in trouble for saying no. But they can get in trouble for saying yes when it's supposed to be no. So they have a tendency to say no just to avoid trouble, a la bureaucracy. So,
the lady at intake that I was dealing with actually did go into a back office, and I assumed it was a supervisor manager.
I would ask to speak to the supervisor directly.
Yeah, because I mean that's the whole point. He's listed on the vehicle, and just have that, you know, have that person. I mean that's the whole point. It's their form. Their form is the, you know, that's.
Now, maybe you have to get the title processed and then come back later. That maybe that's what they're asking.
Yeah.
But go to the higher-ups and ask them.
I don't get it.
A lot of times we find this in, you know, some banks when we're dealing with power of attorneys and estates. You know, the frontline intake doesn't understand the full extent of the law, and they give you bad advice. All right, thanks for the call. Let's go to our break. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers. We'll be right back. Doug Cinceri, Albert Nico, your weekend lawyers, all things legal. We only got about 45 seconds. We're going to have Fans First Take at 1 o'clock with Steve Court and Todd Meneses. About 1 o'clock, we're going to have a countdown to kickoff with Christian and Deuce.
Yeah.
And then we got game time around 3:25 with Zach and Deuce. So it's a football Sunday. And, you know, I want to talk a little bit about Tulane when we get on the other side of the hour. What a great, great event. Great, great game. And, you know, I hope this launches them into a different level. But we'll be back for hour number two in All Things Legal. So stay tuned for national news, local news. See you in 10.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.